In November 1891, Julia Connor announced to Holmes she was pregnant. Now, she told him, he had no choice but to marry her. Holmes reacted to her news with calm and warmth. He held her, stroked her hair, and with moist eyes assured her that she had nothing to worry about. Certainly he would marry her, as he long had promised. There was, however, a condition that he now felt obligated to impose. A child was out of the question. He would marry her only if she agreed to allow him to execute a simple abortion. He was a physician. He had done it before. He would use chloroform, and she would feel nothing, and awaken to the prospect of a new life as Mrs. H. H. Holmes. Children would come later. Right now, there was far too much to do, especially given all the work that lay ahead to complete the hotel and furnish each of its rooms in time for the World's Fair. Holmes knew he possessed great power over Julia. A public pregnancy without marriage meant disgrace and destitution. Holmes possessed Julia now as fully as if she were an antebellum slave, and he reveled in his possession. The operation, he told Julia, would take place on Christmas Eve. Snow fell. Carolers moved along the mansions on Prairie Avenue, pausing now and then to enter the fine houses for hot malt cider and cocoa. The air was scented with wood smoke and roasting duck. At 701 63rd Street in Englewood, Julia Connor put her daughter to bed and did her best to smile and indulge the child's delighted anticipation of Christmas. Yes, St. Nicholas would come, and he would bring wonderful things. Holmes had promised a bounty of toys and sweets for Pearl, and for Julia, something truly grand, beyond anything she could have received from her poor, bland Ned. Julia walked down the hall to an apartment occupied by Mr. and Mrs. John Crow. Julia and Mrs. Crow had become friends, and now Julia helped Mrs. Crow decorate a Christmas tree in the Crow's apartment, meant for Pearl as a Christmas morning surprise. Julia talked of all that she and Pearl would do the next day, and told Mrs. Crow that soon she would be going to Davenport, Iowa, to attend the wedding of an older sister, an old maid, Mrs. Crow said, who to everyone's surprise was about to marry a railroad man. Julia was awaiting the rail pass that the groom was supposed to have put in the mail. Julia left the apartment late that night in good spirits. Mrs. Crow later recalled, there was nothing about her conversation that would lead any of us to think she intended going away that night. Holmes offered Julia a cheerful Merry Christmas and gave her a hug, then took her hand and led her to a room on the second floor that he had readied for the operation. A table lay draped in white linen. His surgical kit stood open and gleaming, his instruments laid out in a sunflower of polished steel. Fearful things. Bone saws, abdomen retractor, trocar and trepan. More instruments certainly than he really needed, and all positioned so that Julia could not help but see them and be sickened by their hard, eager gleam. He wore a white apron and had rolled back his cuffs. Possibly he wore his hat, a bowler. He had not washed his hands, nor did he wear a mask. There was no need. She reached for his hand. There would be no pain, he assured her. She would awaken as healthy as she was now, but without the encumbrance she bore within. He pulled the stopper from a dark amber bottle of liquid and immediately felt its silvery exhalation in his own nostrils. He poured the chloroform into a bunched cloth. She gripped his hand more tightly, which he found singularly arousing. He held the cloth over her nose and mouth. Her eyes fluttered and rolled upward. Then came the inevitable, reflexive disturbance of muscles, like a dream of running. She released his hand, cast it away with splayed fingers. Her feet trembled, as if tapping to a wildly beating drum. His own excitement rose. She tried to pull his hand away, but he was prepared for this sudden surge of muscle stimulation that always preceded stupor, and with great force clamped the cloth to her face. She beat at his arms. Slowly the energy left her, and her hands began to move in slow arcs, soothing and sensuous, the wild drums silent. Ballet now, a pastoral exit. He kept one hand on the cloth, and with the other dribbled more of the liquid between his fingers into its folds. delighting in the sensation of frost where the chloroform coated his fingers. One of her wrists sagged to the table, followed shortly by the other. Her eyelids stuttered, then closed. He removed the apron and rolled down his sleeves. The chloroform and his own intense arousal made him feel lightheaded. He stoppered the chloroform, found a fresh cloth, and walked down the hall to Pearl's room. It took only a moment to bunch the fresh cloth and douse it with chloroform. In the hall afterward, he examined his watch and saw that it was Christmas. On Christmas morning, the crows waited for Julia and Pearl in glad anticipation of watching the girls' eyes ignite upon spotting the lovely tree and presents arrayed under its boughs. The apartment was warm, the air rouged with cinnamon and fir. An hour passed. The crows waited as long as they could, but at 10 o'clock they set out to catch a train for central Chicago, where they planned to visit friends. They left the apartment unlocked, with a cheerful note of welcome. The crows returned at 11 o'clock that night and found everything as they had left it, with no evidence that Julia and her daughter had come. The next morning, they tried Julia's apartment, but no one answered. They asked neighbors inside and outside the building if any had seen Julia or Pearl, but none had. When Holmes next appeared, Mrs. Crow asked him where Julia might be. He explained that she and Pearl had gone to Davenport earlier than expected. Mrs. Crow heard nothing more from Julia. She and her neighbors thought the whole thing very odd. They all agreed that the last time anyone had seen Julia or Pearl was Christmas Eve. This was not precisely accurate. Others did see Julia again, although by then, no one, not even her own family back in Davenport, Iowa, could have been expected to recognize her. Just after Christmas, Holmes asked one of his associates, Charles Chappelle, to come to his building. Holmes had learned that Chappelle was an articulator, meaning he had mastered the art of stripping the flesh from human bodies and reassembling or articulating the bones to form complete skeletons for display in doctors' offices and laboratories. He had acquired the necessary techniques while articulating cadavers for medical students at Cook County Hospital. During his own medical education, Holmes had seen firsthand how desperate schools were to acquire corpses, whether freshly dead or skeletonized. The serious, systematic study of medicine was intensifying, and to scientists, the human body was like the polar ice cap, something to be studied and explored. Skeletons hung in doctors' offices where they served as visual encyclopedias. With demand outpacing supply, doctors established a custom of graciously and discreetly accepting any offered cadaver. They frowned on murder as a means of harvest. On the other hand, they made little effort to explore the provenance of any one body. Grave robbing became an industry, albeit a small one, requiring an exceptional degree of sang-froid. In periods of acute shortage, doctors themselves helped mine the newly departed. Holmes had an eye for opportunity, and with demand for corpses so robust, opportunity now beckoned. He showed Charles Chappelle into a second-floor room that contained a table, medical instruments, and bottles of solvents. These did not trouble Chappelle, nor did the corpse on the table, for Chappelle knew that Holmes was a physician. The body was clearly that of a woman, although of unusual height. He saw nothing to indicate her identity. The body, he said, looked like that of a jackrabbit which had been skinned by splitting the skin down the face and rolling it back off the entire body. In some places, considerable of the flesh had been taken off with it. Holmes explained that he'd been doing some dissection, but now had completed his research. He offered Chappelle $36 to cleanse the bones and skull and return to him a fully articulated skeleton. Chappelle agreed. Holmes and Chappelle placed the body in a trunk lined with duck cloth. An express company delivered it to Chappelle's house. Soon afterwards, Chappelle returned with the skeleton. Holmes thanked him, paid him, and promptly sold the skeleton to Hahnemann Medical College, the Chicago school, not the Philadelphia school of the same name, for many times the amount he had paid Chappelle. In the second week of January 1892, new tenants, the Doyle family, moved into Julia's quarters in Holmes' building. They found dishes on the table and Pearl's clothes hung over a chair. The place looked and felt as if the former occupants planned to return within minutes. The Doyles asked Holmes what had happened. With his voice striking the perfect sober note, Holmes apologized for the disarray and explained that Julia's sister had fallen gravely ill, and Julia and her daughter had left at once for the train station. There was no need to pack up their belongings, as Julia and Pearl were well provided for and would not be coming back. 1892 broke cold with 6 inches of snow on the ground and temperatures falling to 10 degrees below zero. Certainly not the coldest weather Chicago ever experienced, but cold enough to clot the valves of all three of the city water system's intake valves and temporarily halt the flow of Chicago's drinking water. Despite the weather, work at Jackson Park progressed. Workers erected a heated, movable shelter that allowed them to apply staff to the exterior of the mines and mining building no matter what the temperature. The woman's building was nearly done, all of its scaffolding gone. The giant manufacturer's building had begun rising above its foundation. In all, the workforce in the park numbered 4,000. The ranks included a carpenter and furniture maker named Elias Disney, who in coming years would tell many stories about the construction of this magical realm beside the lake. His son, Walt, would take note. Beyond the exposition's 8-foot fence and its 2 tiers of barbed wire, there was tumult. Wage reductions and layoffs stoked unrest among workers nationwide. Unions gained strength. The constant threat of strike and the onset of deep cold shaded the new year for Burnham, but what most concerned him was the fast shrinking treasury of the exposition company. In advancing the work so quickly and on such a grand scale, Burnham's department had consumed far more money than anyone had anticipated. There was talk now among the directors of seeking a $10 million appropriation from Congress, but the only immediate solution was to reduce expenditures. On January 6th, Burnham commanded his department chiefs to take immediate, in some cases draconian, measures to cut costs. He ordered his chief draftsman in charge of exposition work underway in the attic of the rookery to fire at once any man who did inaccurate or slouchy work or who failed to do more than his full duty. Until this point, Burnham had shown a level of compassion for his workers that was extraordinary for the time. He paid them even when illness or injury kept them out of work and established an exposition hospital which provided free medical care. But now even the fair was laying off men, and the timing was awful. With the advent of winter, the traditional building season had come to an end. The dismissed men, Burnham knew, faced homelessness and poverty. Their families confronted the real prospect of starvation. But the fair came first. Burnham needed more power, not for his own ego, but for the sake of the exposition. Unless the pace of decision-making accelerated, he knew the fair would fall irreparably behind schedule. Yet if anything, the barriers to efficiency were increasing in size and number. The exposition company's shrinking war chest had driven its relationship with the National Commission to a new low, with Director General Davis arguing that any new federal money should be controlled by his commission. The commission seemed to form new departments every day, each with a paid chief. Davis named a superintendent of sheep for a salary equivalent to $60,000 a year, and each claiming some piece of jurisdiction that Burnham thought belonged to him. Soon the struggle for control distilled to a personal conflict between Burnham and Davis, its primary battlefield a disagreement over who should control the artistic design of exhibits and interiors. Burnham thought it obvious that the territory belonged to him. Davis believed otherwise. The directors of the exposition company did decide to seek a direct appropriation from Congress, but their request triggered a congressional investigation of the fair's expenditures. Burnham and President Baker expected a general review, but instead found themselves grilled about the most mundane expenses. The congressional investigators left for Washington to study the evidence and report on whether an appropriation was warranted. The congressmen, Burnham wrote, are dazed with the size and scope of this enterprise. Once Bloom arrived in Chicago, the fair's midway plaisance began to take shape. On paper, at least. He placed notices in publications around the world to make it known that the Midway was to be an exotic realm of unusual sights, sounds, and scents. There would be authentic villages from far-off lands inhabited by authentic villagers, even pygmies, if Lieutenant Shufeldt succeeded. Bloom recognized also that as Tsar of the Midway, he no longer had to worry about seeking a concession for his Algerian village. He could approve the village himself. He produced a contract and sent it off to Paris. In the spring of 1892, Holmes' assistant, Benjamin Petitzel, found himself in the city of Dwight, Illinois, about 75 miles southwest of Chicago, taking the famous Keeley cure for alcoholism. Patients stayed in the three-story Livingston Hotel, a red brick building of simple, appealing design, with arched windows and a veranda along the full length of its facade. A fine place to rest between injections of Dr. Leslie Enrot Keeley's Gold Cure. Gold was the most famous ingredient in a red, white, and blue solution nicknamed the barber pole that employees of the Keeley Institute injected into patients' arms 3 times a day. The rest of the formula was kept secret, but as best doctors and chemists could tell, the solution included substances that imparted a pleasant state of euphoria and sedation trimmed with amnesia. Petitzel had long been a heavy drinker, but his drinking must have become debilitating, for it was Holmes who sent him to Keeley and paid for his treatment. He explained it to Petitzel as a gesture born of kindness, a return for Petitzel's loyalty. As always, he had other motives. It's likely Holmes also wanted Petitzel to gather whatever intelligence he could about the cure and its labeling so that he could mimic the product and sell it through his own mail-order drug company. Petitzel returned to Englewood in April. The psychotropic powers of Keeley's injections may account for the story Petitzel now told Holmes, of how at Keeley he had met a young woman of great beauty, to hear him tell it preternatural beauty, named Emmeline Segrand. She was blonde, 24 years old, and since 1891 had worked as a stenographer in Dr. Keeley's office. Petitzel's almost hallucinatory description must have tantalized Holmes, for he wrote to Segrand and offered her a job as his personal secretary, at twice the salary she was making in Keeley. A flattering offer, as a member of the Segrand family later described it. Emmeline accepted without hesitation. The Institute had a certain cachet, but the village of Dwight was no Chicago. To be able to earn twice her salary and live in that city of legendary glamour and excitement, with the World's Fair set to open in a year, made the offer irresistible. She left Keeley in May, bringing along her $800 in savings. Upon arriving in Englewood, she rented rooms in a boarding house near Holmes' building. Petitzel had exaggerated Emmeline's beauty, Holmes saw, but not by much. She was indeed lovely, with luminous blonde hair. Immediately, Holmes deployed his tools of seduction, his soothing voice, and touch, and frank blue gaze. One afternoon, as Emmeline sat before her typewriter in Holmes' office, a man entered, looking for Holmes. He introduced himself as Ned Connor, and said he once had run the jewelry counter in the pharmacy downstairs. He had come to discuss a problem with a mortgage. She knew the name, had heard it somewhere, or seen it in Holmes' papers. She smiled and told Ned that Holmes was out of the building. She had no idea when he would return. Could she help? Ned and Emmeline got to talking about Holmes, as Ned later recalled. From his own hard experience, and from the look of adoration that entered Emmeline's eyes when she spoke of Holmes, Ned guessed her relationship involved a good deal more than typewriting. Later, he recalled, "I told her I thought he was a bad lot, and that she had better have little to do with him, and get away from him as soon as possible." For the time being, at least, she ignored his advice. On May 1st, 1892, a doctor named M.B. Lawrence and his wife moved into a 5-room apartment in Holmes' building, where they often encountered Emmeline, although Emmeline herself did not yet live in the building. She still occupied rooms in a nearby boarding house. "She was one of the prettiest and most pleasant young women I ever met," said Dr. Lawrence, "and my wife and I learned to think a great deal of her. We saw her every day, and she often came in for a few minutes' chat with Mrs. Lawrence." The Lawrences often saw Emmeline in Holmes' company. "It was not long," Dr. Lawrence said, "before I became aware that the relations between Miss Segrand and Mr. Holmes were not strictly those of an employer and an employee, but we felt that she was to be more pitied than blamed." Olmsted's teeth hurt. His ears roared and he could not sleep. Yet throughout the first months of 1892, he kept up a pace that would have been punishing for a man one-third his age. He traveled to Chicago, Asheville, Knoxville, Louisville, and Rochester, each overnight leg compounding his distress. In Chicago, despite the tireless efforts of his young lieutenant Harry Codman, the work was far behind schedule, the task ahead growing more enormous by the day. The first major deadline, the dedication set for October 21, 1892, seemed impossibly near, and would have seemed even more so had not fair officials changed the original date, October 12th, to allow New York City to hold its own Columbus celebration. Construction delays elsewhere on the grounds were especially frustrating for Olmsted. When contractors fell behind, his own work fell behind. His completed work also suffered. Workmen trampled his plantings and destroyed his roads. The delays and damage angered Olmsted, but other matters distressed him even more. Despite Olmsted's hectoring, Burnham seemed to consider steam-powered launches an acceptable choice for the exposition's boat service, and no one seemed to share his conviction that the wooded island must remain free of all structures. The island had come under repeated assault, prompting a resurfacing of an old anger in Olmsted about the compulsion of clients to tinker with his landscapes. Everyone wanted space on the island. Theodore Roosevelt, head of the U.S. Civil Service Commission, insisted that the island was perfect for the hunting camp exhibit of his Boone and Crockett Club. Not surprisingly, given Roosevelt's power in Washington, the politicians of the Fair's National Commission strongly endorsed his plan. Olmsted agreed to let Roosevelt place his camp on a lesser island, but would not allow any buildings, only a few tents, some horses, campfire, etc. Later, he permitted the installation of a small hunter's cabin. Next came the U.S. government seeking to place an Indian exhibit on the island, and after this, Professor Putnam, the Fair's chief of ethnology, who saw the island as an ideal site for several exotic villages. The government of Japan also wanted the island. They propose an outdoor exhibit of their temples, and as has been usual, they desire space on the wooded island, Burnham wrote in February 1892. To Burnham, it now seemed inevitable that something would occupy the island. The setting was just too appealing. Burnham urged Olmsted to accept Japan's proposal. Fearing much worse, Olmsted agreed. His insomnia and pain, the crushing workload, his mounting frustration, all tore at his spirit, until by the end of March, he felt himself on the verge of physical and emotional collapse. The intermittent depression that had shadowed him throughout his adult life was about to envelop him once again. "When Olmsted is blue," a friend once wrote, "the logic of his despondency is crushing and terrible." Olmsted, however, believed all he needed was a good rest. In keeping with the therapeutic mores of the age, he decided to do his convalescing in Europe, where the scenery also would provide an opportunity to enrich his visual vocabulary. He planned forays to public gardens and parks and the grounds of the old Paris Exposition. He put his eldest son John in charge of the Brookline office and left Harry Codman in Chicago to guide the work on the World's Fair. Burnham fought to boost the rate of construction, especially of the manufacturer's building, which had to be completed by dedication day. In March, with just half a year remaining until the dedication, he invoked the Czar Clause of his construction contracts. He ordered the builder of the electricity building to double his workforce and to put the men to work at night under electric lights. He threatened the manufacturer's contractor with the same fate if he did not increase the pace of his work. Burnham had all but given up hope of surpassing the Eiffel Tower. Most recently, he had turned down an outlandish idea from an earnest young Pittsburgh engineer who had attended a lecture Burnham had given to the Saturday Afternoon Club. The man was credible enough. His company held the contract for inspecting all the steel used in the fair structures, but the thing he proposed to build just did not seem feasible. Too fragile, Burnham told him. The public, he said, would be afraid. To find ways to accelerate the work, Burnham called the Eastern architects to Chicago. One looming problem was how to color the exteriors of the main buildings. During the meeting, an idea arose that in the end promised a dramatic acceleration of the work. No one could have foretold how this one decision would forever fix the fair in the world's imagination as a thing of otherworldly beauty. By all rights, the arena of exterior decoration belonged to William Prettyman, the fair's official director of color. Burnham admitted later that he had hired Prettyman for the job largely on account of his great friendship for John Root. Prettyman was ill-suited to the job. Harriet Monroe, who knew him and his wife, wrote, "His genius was betrayed by lofty and indomitable traits of character, which could not yield or compromise, and so his life was a tragedy of inconsequence." The day of the meeting, Prettyman was on the East Coast. The architects proceeded without him. "I was urging everyone on, knowing I had an awful fight against time," Burnham said. "We talked about the colors, and finally the thought came, let us make it all perfectly white. I do not remember who made that suggestion. It might have been one of those things that reached all minds at once. At any rate, I decided it." The Mines building, designed by Chicago's Solon S. Beeman, was nearly finished. It became the test building. Burnham ordered it painted a creamy white. Prettyman returned and was outraged, Burnham recalled. Prettyman insisted that any decision on color was his alone. "I don't see it that way," Burnham told him. "The decision is mine." "All right," Prettyman said, "I will get out." Burnham did not miss him. "He was a brooding sort of man and very cranky," Burnham said. "I let him go, then told Charles McKim that I would have to have a man who could actually take charge of it and that I would not decide from the point of friendship." McKim recommended the New York painter Francis Millet, who had sat in on the color meeting. In July, the executive committee formally approved Millet's appointment, but for only half the salary Burnham had offered. By then, however, Millet had fallen for the fair and for Burnham, and would have stayed even if the committee had cut his salary to nothing. Millet quickly proved his worth. After some experimentation, he settled on ordinary white lead and oil as the best paint for staff, then developed a means of applying the paint not by brush, but through a hose with a special nozzle fashioned from a length of gas pipe, the first spray paint. Burnham nicknamed Millet and his paint crews the Whitewash Gang. Burnham intensified his drive for more power. The constant clash between the Exposition Company and the National Commission had become nearly unbearable. Even the congressional investigators had recognized that the overlapping jurisdiction was a source of discord and needless expense. Their report recommended that Davis's salary be cut in half, a clear sign that the balance of power had shifted. The company and commission worked out a truce. On August 24th, the executive committee named Burnham Director of Works, chief of everything. Soon afterward, Burnham dispatched letters to all his department heads, including Olmsted. "I have assumed personal control of the active works within the grounds of the World's Columbian Exposition," he wrote. "Henceforward and until further notice, you will report to and receive orders from me exclusively." In Pittsburgh, the young steel engineer became more convinced than ever that his challenge to the Eiffel Tower could succeed. He asked a partner in his inspection firm, W.F. Gronau, to calculate the novel forces that would play among the components of his structure. In engineering parlance, it embodied little dead load, the statistic weight of immobile masses of brick and steel. Nearly all of it was live load, meaning weight that changes over time, as when a train passes over a bridge. "I had no precedent," Gronau said. After 3 weeks of intense work, however, he came up with detailed specifications. The numbers were persuasive, even to Burnham. In June, the Ways and Means Committee agreed that the thing should be built. They granted a concession. The next day, the committee revoked it. Second thoughts, after a night spent dreaming of freak winds and shrieking steel, and 2,000 lives gone in a wink. One member of the committee now called it a monstrosity. A chorus of engineers chanted the thing could not be built, at least not with any margin of safety. Its young designer still did not concede defeat, however. He spent $25,000 on drawings and additional specifications and used these to recruit a cadre of investors that included two prominent engineers. Soon he sensed a change. The new man in charge of the Midway, Saul Bloom, had struck like a bolt of lightning and seemed amenable to just about anything. The more novel and startling, the better. And Burnham had gained almost limitless power over the construction and operation of the fair. The engineer readied himself for a third try. In England, Olmsted was driven by carriage through the countryside to view gardens, churchyards, private parks, and the natural landscape. His sorties through the English countryside made him recognize that the wildness he sought in Chicago would have to be tempered with excellent groundskeeping. In the first week of September 1892, Olmsted and his party left England for home, departing Liverpool aboard the City of New York. The seas were high, the crossing difficult. Olmsted's health again declined. He wrote, "I was more disabled when I returned than when I left." Now, however, he had no time to recuperate. Dedication Day was only a month away, and Harry Codman was ill, incapacitated by a stomach problem that had first struck him earlier that summer. Olmsted left for Chicago to take over direct supervision of the work while Codman recovered. In Chicago, he found a changed park. The mines building was done, as was the fisheries building. Most of the other buildings were well underway, including, incredibly, the giant manufacturers building, where hundreds of workers swarmed its scaffolds and roof. The building's floor alone had consumed 5 train carloads of nails. Amid all this work, however, the landscape had suffered. Temporary tracks latticed the grounds. Wagons had gouged chasms across paths, roads, and would-be lawns. Litter lay everywhere. A first-time visitor might wonder if Olmsted's men had done any work at all. Olmsted, of course, knew that tremendous progress had been made, but it was the sort that escaped casual notice. Lagoons existed now where once there had been barren land. The elevated sites upon which the building stood had not existed until his grading teams created them. The previous spring, his men had planted nearly everything raised in the exposition's nurseries, plus an additional 200,000 trees, aquatic plants, and ferns, and 30,000 more willow cuttings. Another positive development had occurred during his absence. Burnham had awarded the boat concession to a company called the Electric Launch and Navigation Company, which had produced a lovely electric vessel of exactly the character Olmsted wanted. On Dedication Day, even the press was polite enough to overlook the stark appearance of the grounds and the unfinished feel of the manufacturer's building. To have done otherwise would have been an act of disloyalty to Chicago and the nation. The dedication had been anticipated nationwide. Francis J. Bellamy, an editor of Youth's Companion, thought it would be a fine thing if on that day all the school children of America, in unison, offered something to their nation. He composed a pledge which the Bureau of Education mailed to virtually every school. It began, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America." A great parade brought Burnham and other dignitaries to the manufacturer's building, where 140,000 Chicagoans filled the 32-acre floor. Shafts of sunlight struck through the rising mist of human breath. 5,000 yellow chairs stood on the red-carpeted speaker's platform, and in these chairs sat businessmen dressed in black, foreign commissioners and clerics in scarlet, purple, green, and gold. Ex-Mayor Carter Harrison, running now for a fifth term, strode about shaking hands, his black slouch hat raising cheers from supporters in the crowd. At the opposite end of the building was a 5,000-voice choir which sang Handel's Hallelujah Chorus to the accompaniment of 500 musicians. At one point, a spectator recalled, 90,000 people suddenly rose and stood upon their feet, and simultaneously waved and fluttered 90,000 snowy pocket handkerchiefs. The air was cut into dusty spirals which vibrated to the great iron-ribbed ceiling. One had a sense of dizziness, as if the entire building rocked. On November 28, 1892, Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast, the mad Irish immigrant, selected one of his postal cards. He was 24 years old now, and despite his accelerating mental decline, was still employed as a delivery contractor. The card, like all the others, was 4 inches wide by 5 inches long, blank on one face, with postal insignia and a printed 1-cent stamp on the other. In this time, when writing long letters was everyday practice, men of normal sensibility saw these cards as the most crabbed of all media, little better than telegrams. But to Prendergast, this square of stiff paper was a vehicle that gave him voice in the skyscrapers and mansions of the city. He addressed this particular card to A.S. Trude, lawyer. That Prendergast selected Trude to be one of his correspondents was not surprising. Prendergast read widely and possessed a good grasp of the grip car wrecks, murders, and city hall machinations covered so fervently by the city's newspapers. He knew that Alfred S. Trude was one of Chicago's best criminal defense attorneys, and that from time to time he was hired by the state to serve as prosecutor, a practice customary in particularly important cases. Prendergast filled the postcard from top margin to bottom, from edge to edge, with little regard for whether the sentences formed level lines or not. "My dear Mr. Trude," he began, "were you much hurt?" An accident reported in the press had caused Trude minor injuries. "Your humble servant hereby begs leave to tender you his sincere sympathy." He wrote with a tone of familiarity that presumed Trude would consider him a peer. The note clicked from theme to theme like the wheels of a train crossing a freight yard. Prendergast did not add a closing and did not sign the note. He simply ran out of room, then posted the card. Trude read the note and at first dismissed it as the work of a crank. The number of troubled men and women seemed to be increasing with each passing year. The jails were full of them, a warden later would testify. Inevitably, some became dangerous, like Charles Guiteau, the man who assassinated President Garfield in Washington. For no clear reason, Trude kept the card. In late November, the young Pittsburgh engineer once again put his proposal for out-Eiffeling Eiffel before the Ways and Means Committee. This time, in addition to drawings and specifications, he included a list of investors, the names of the prominent men on his board, and proof that he had raised enough money to finance the project to completion. On December 16, 1892, the committee granted him a concession to build his structure in the Midway Plaisance. This time, the decision held. He needed an engineer willing to go to Chicago and supervise the construction effort, and thought he knew just the man, Luther V. Rice, assistant engineer of the Union Depot and Tunnel Company, St. Louis. His letter to Rice began, "I have on hand a great project for the World's Fair in Chicago. I am going to build a vertically revolving wheel 250 feet in diameter." Nowhere in this letter, however, did he reveal the true dimension of his vision. That this wheel would carry 36 cars, each the size of a Pullman, each holding 60 people and equipped with its own lunch counter, and how, when filled to capacity, the wheel would propel 2,160 people at a time 300 feet into the sky over Jackson Park, a bit higher than the crown of the now 6-year-old Statue of Liberty. He told Rice, "I want you at once if you can come." He signed the letter, "George Washington Gale Ferris." One day in the first week of December 1892, Emmeline Segrand set out for Holmes' building in Englewood, bearing a small, neatly wrapped parcel. Initially, her mood was bright, for the parcel contained an early Christmas present she planned to give to her friends, the Lawrences. But as she neared the corner of 63rd and Wallace, her spirits dimmed. Where once the building had seemed almost a palace, not for its architectural nobility, but for what it promised, now it looked drab and worn. She climbed the stairs to the second floor and went directly to the Lawrences' apartment. The warmth and welcome resurrected her good spirits. She handed the parcel to Mrs. Lawrence, who opened it immediately and pulled from the wrapping a tin plate upon which Emmeline had painted a lovely forest. The gift delighted Mrs. Lawrence, but also perplexed her. Christmas was only 3 weeks off, she said kindly. Why hadn't Emmeline simply waited and given the plate then, when Mrs. Lawrence could have offered a gift in return? Her face brightening, Emmeline explained that she was going home to Indiana to spend Christmas with her family. She seemed delighted with the anticipation of a visit to them, Mrs. Lawrence said. She spoke in most affectionate terms of them and seemed as happy as a child. But Mrs. Lawrence also sensed a note of finality in Emmeline's voice that suggested Emmeline's journey might have another purpose. She said, "You are not going away from us." "Well," Emmeline said, "I don't know. Maybe." Mrs. Lawrence laughed. "Why, Mr. Holmes could never get along without you." Emmeline's expression changed. He could if he had to. The remark confirmed something for the Lawrences. "It had seemed to me for some time that Miss Segrand was changing in her feelings toward Holmes," said Dr. Lawrence. "In the light of what has happened since, I believe now that she had found out to a certain extent the real character of Holmes and determined to leave him." Emmeline may have begun to believe the stories she heard in the neighborhood of Holmes' penchant for acquiring things on credit and then not paying for them, stories she had heard all along, for they were rife. but that she at first dismissed as the gossip of envious hearts. Later, there was speculation that Emmeline herself had trusted Holmes with her $800 savings, only to have it disappear in a fog of promises and lavish future returns. Ned Connor's warning echoed in her mind. Lately, she had begun talking of returning one day to Dwight to resume her work for Dr. Keeley. Emmeline never told the Lawrences goodbye. Her visits simply stopped. That she would leave without a parting word struck Mrs. Lawrence as being very much out of character. She wasn't sure whether to feel wounded or worried. She asked Holmes what he knew about Emmeline's absence. Ordinarily, Holmes looked at Mrs. Lawrence with a directness that was unsettling, but now he avoided her gaze. "Oh, she's gone away to get married," Holmes said, as if nothing could have interested him less. The news shocked Mrs. Lawrence. "I don't see why she didn't mention something to me about getting married." "It was a secret," Holmes explained. Emmeline and her betrothed had revealed their wedding plans only to him. In the days that followed, Mrs. Lawrence began to think of Emmeline's departure as a disappearance, and recalled that soon after Emmeline's last visit, a curious change in routine had occurred within Holmes' building. The day after Miss Grant disappeared, or the day we last saw her, the door of Holmes' office was kept locked, and nobody went into it except Holmes and Patrick Quinlan, Mrs. Lawrence said. About 7 o'clock in the evening, Holmes came out of his office and asked two men who were living in the building if they would not help him carry a trunk downstairs. The trunk was new and large, about 4 feet long. Its contents clearly were heavy and made the big trunk difficult to manage. Holmes repeatedly cautioned his helpers to be careful with it. An express wagon arrived and took it away. Mrs. Lawrence later claimed that at this point she became convinced Holmes had killed Emmeline. Yet she and her husband made no effort to move from the building, nor did they go to the police. No one did. It was as if no one expected the police would be interested in yet another disappearance, or if they were, that they would be competent enough to conduct an effective investigation. At the start of January 1893, the weather turned cold and stayed cold, the temperature falling to 20 degrees below zero. In his dawn tours, Burnham faced a hard, pale world. Cairns of frozen horse manure punctuated the landscape. Along the banks of the wooded island, ice 2 feet thick locked Olmsted's bulrush and sedge in cruel contortions. Burnham saw that Olmsted's work was far behind, and now Olmsted's man in Chicago, Harry Codman, upon whom everyone had come to depend, was in the hospital recovering from surgery. His recurring illness had turned out to be appendicitis. The operation under ether had gone well, and Codman was recuperating, but his recovery would be slow. Only 4 months remained until opening day. The demands on Burnham multiplied with each new day. Most nights he got only 5 hours of sleep, sometimes only three. He wrote to his family, but did not see them. He looked forward to the closing hours of each night, when he and his associates would gather before the shanty hearth with cigars and Madeira, the group endlessly buoyed by Frank Millet's bawdy good humor. Dedication Day had gone well, but Burnham could sense the charity in the glowing appraisals of friends. The real test was opening day. There would be less charity, greater expectation. More progress had to be made, and faster. Thankfully, Harry Codman seemed to be recovering nicely. At night, as the ice deepened and settled, pistol-shot fractures raced across the lagoon. On the lake, nothing moved. The darkness was absolute. Olmsted in Brookline got the news by telegram. Harry Codman was dead. Codman, his protege, who he loved like a son. He was 29. Olmsted recognized that now he himself would have to take over direct supervision of the exposition work, but he felt less up to the duty than ever. He and Harry's brother, Phil Codman, arrived in Chicago at the beginning of February to find the city locked in brutal cold, the temperature 8 degrees below zero. On February 4th, he sat down at Codman's desk for the first time and found it awash with stacks of invoices and memoranda. Olmsted's head raged with noise and pain. He had a sore throat. He was deeply sad. The task of sorting through Codman's accumulated papers and of taking over the exposition work now seemed beyond him. He asked a former assistant, Charles Elliott, now one of Boston's best landscape architects, if he would come to help. After some hesitation, Elliot agreed. On arrival, Elliot saw immediately that Olmsted was ill. By the evening of February 17, 1893, as a blizzard bore down on Chicago, Olmsted was under a doctor's care, confined to his hotel. By early March, Olmsted and Elliot were back in Brookline, Elliot now a full-fledged partner, the firm newly renamed Olmsted, Olmsted & Elliot. The exposition work was still far behind schedule and a major source of worry, but Olmsted's health and the pressure of other work had forced him from Chicago. With deep misgivings, Olmsted had left the work in the care of his superintendent, Rudolf Ulrich, whom he had come to distrust. On March 11th, Olmsted dispatched a long letter to Ulrich, full of instructions as well as identifying the things that most worried him about the fair. Clearly, the possibility of failure at the exposition had occurred to Olmsted and troubled him. Time was short, the weather terrible. The spring planting season would be brief. For Holmes, despite the persistent deep cold of the first 2 months of 1893, things never looked better. With Emmeline gone and neatly disposed of, he now was able to concentrate on his growing web of enterprise. He savored its scope. He owned a portion of a legitimate company that produced a machine for duplicating documents. He sold mail-order ointments and elixirs, and by now had established his own alcohol treatment company, the Silver Ash Institute, his answer to Keeley's gold cure. He collected rents from the Lawrences and his other tenants, and owned two houses, one on Honoré Street, the other the new house in Wilmette, now occupied by his wife Myrta and daughter Lucy, which he himself had designed and then built with the help of as many as 75 largely unpaid workers. And soon he would begin receiving his first World's Fair guests. He spent much of his time outfitting his hotel. He acquired high-grade furnishings from the Toby Furniture Company and crystal and ceramics from the French Potter Crockery Company, and did so without paying a dime, though he recognized that soon the companies would attempt to collect on the promissory notes he had given them. This did not worry him. He had learned through experience that delay and heartfelt remorse were powerful tools with which he could fend off creditors for months and years, sometimes forever. Such prolonged standoffs would not be necessary, however, for he sensed that his time in Chicago was nearing an end. Mrs. Lawrence's questioning had become more pointed, almost accusing, and lately some of his creditors had begun exhibiting an extraordinary hardening of resolve. Far more annoying were the letters from parents of missing daughters and the private detectives who had begun showing up at his door. Independently of each other, the Segrand and Connor families had hired eyes to search for their missing daughters. Although at first these inquiries troubled Holmes, he realized quickly that neither family believed he had anything to do with the disappearances. The detectives made no mention of suspecting foul play. They wanted information, the names of friends, forwarding addresses, suggestions on where to look next. He was, of course, happy to oblige. Holmes told his visitors how much it grieved him, truly, deeply grieved him, that he was unable to provide any new information to ease the worry of the parents. If he heard from the women, he of course would notify the detectives at once. At the moment, March 1893, the greatest inconvenience confronting Holmes was his lack of help. He needed a new secretary. Fortune brought him the perfect acquisition. Her name was Minnie R. Williams. He had met her several years earlier during a stay in Boston, and had considered acquiring her even then, but the distance was too great, the timing awkward. Now she had moved to Chicago. Holmes guessed that he himself might be part of the reason. She would be 25 years old by now. Unlike his usual selections, she was plain, short, and plump, her weight somewhere between 140 and 150. She had a masculine nose, thick dark eyebrows, and virtually no neck. Her expression was bland, her cheeks full. A baby face, as one witness put it. She didn't seem to know a great deal. In Boston, however, Holmes had discovered that she possessed other winning attributes. Born in Mississippi, Minnie Williams and her younger sister Anna were orphaned at an early age and sent to live with different uncles. Anna's guardian was the Reverend Dr. W.C. Black of Jackson, Mississippi, editor of the Methodist Christian Advocate. Minnie went to Texas, where her guardian uncle was a successful businessman. He treated her well and in 1886 enrolled her at the Boston Academy of Elocution. He died in the midst of her 3-year program and bequeathed to her an estate valued at between $50,000 and $100,000, about $1.5 million to $3 million in 21st century dollars. Anna, meanwhile, became a schoolteacher. She taught in Midlothian, Texas at the Midlothian Academy. When Holmes met Minnie, he was traveling on business under the alias Henry Gordon and found himself invited to a gathering at the home of one of Boston's leading families. Through various inquiries, Holmes learned of Minnie's inheritance and that it consisted largely of a parcel of property in the heart of Fort Worth, Texas. Holmes extended his Boston stay. Minnie called him Harry. He took her to plays and concerts and bought her flowers and books and sweets. Wooing her was pathetically easy. Each time he told her he had to return to Chicago, she seemed crushed, delightfully so. Throughout 1889, he traveled regularly to Boston and always swept Minnie into a whirl of shows and dinners, although what he looked forward to most were the days before his departure when her need flared like fire in a dry forest. After a time, however, he tired of the game. The distance was too great, Minnie's reticence too profound. His visits to Boston became fewer, though he still responded to her letters with the ardor of a lover. Holmes' absence broke Minnie's heart. She had fallen in love with him. His visits had thrilled her. His departures destroyed her. She missed his warmth and touch. She moved to Chicago in February 1893 and took a job as a stenographer for a law firm. She wrote to Harry to tell him of her arrival. Harry Gordon called on her almost immediately and greeted her with tears in his eyes. He was so affectionate. It was as if they had never parted. He suggested she come work for him as his personal stenographer. They could see each other every day without having to worry about the interventions of Minnie's landlady, who watched them as if she were Minnie's own mother. The prospect thrilled her. He said nothing about marriage, but she could tell he loved her, and this was Chicago. Things were different here, less rigid and formal. Everywhere she went, she found women her own age, unescorted, holding jobs, living their own lives. She accepted Harry's offer. He seemed delighted. But he imposed a curious stipulation. Minnie was to refer to him in public as Henry Howard Holmes, an alias, he explained, that he had adopted for business reasons. She was never to call him Gordon, nor act surprised when people referred to him as Dr. Holmes. She could call him Harry at any time, however. She managed his correspondence and kept his books while he concentrated on getting his building ready for the World's Fair. They dined together in his office, on meals brought in from the restaurant below. Minnie showed a remarkable aptitude for the work, Holmes wrote in his memoir. During the first weeks, she boarded at a distance, but later, from about the 1st of March until the 15th of May, 1893, she occupied rooms in the same building and adjoining my offices. Harry touched her and caressed her and let his eyes fill with tears of adoration. At last he asked her to marry him. She felt very lucky. Her Harry was so handsome and dynamic. She knew that once married, they would share a wonderful life full of travel and fine possessions. She wrote of her hopes to her sister Anna. In recent years, the sisters had become very close, overcoming an earlier estrangement. They wrote to each other often. Minnie filled her letters with news of her fast intensifying romance and expressed wonder that such a handsome man had chosen her to be his wife. Anna was skeptical. The romance was advancing too quickly, and with a degree of intimacy that violated all the intricate rules of courtship. Minnie was sweet, Anna knew, but certainly no beauty. If Harry Gordon was such a paragon of looks and enterprise, why had he selected her? Holmes promised Minnie a voyage to Europe, art lessons, a fine home, and of course children. He adored children. But first there were certain financial matters that required their mutual attention. Assuring her that he had come up with a plan from which only great profit would result, Holmes persuaded her to transfer the deed of her Fort Worth land to a man named Alexander Bond. She did so on April 18, 1893, with Holmes himself serving as notary. Bond in turn signed the deed over to another man, Benton T. Lyman. Holmes notarized this transfer as well. Minnie loved her husband-to-be and trusted him, but she did not know that Alexander Bond was an alias for Holmes himself, or that Benton Lyman was actually Holmes' assistant, Benjamin Petiesel, and that with a few strokes of his pen, her beloved Harry had taken possession of the bulk of her dead uncle's bequest. Nor did she know that on paper Harry was still married to two other women, Clara Lovering and Myrta Belknap, and that in each marriage he had fathered a child. Holmes, Harry, wanted the wedding done quickly and quietly, just him, Minnie, and Preacher. He arranged everything. To Minnie, the little ceremony appeared to be legal and, in its quiet way, very romantic. But in fact, no record of their union was entered into the marriage registry of Cook County, Illinois. Throughout the spring of 1893, the streets of Chicago filled with unemployed men from elsewhere, but otherwise the city seemed immune from the nation's financial troubles. Preparations for the fair kept its economy robust, if artificially so. Construction of the Alley L extension to Jackson Park still provided work for hundreds of men. At Jackson Park, exhibits arrived daily in ever-mounting volume. There was smoke, clatter, mud, and confusion, as if an army were massing for an assault on Chicago. Caravans of Wells Fargo and Adams Express wagons moved slowly through the park, drawn by gigantic horses. Throughout the night, freight trains huffed into the park. Switching locomotives nudged individual boxcars over the skein of temporary tracks to their destinations. Lake freighters disgorged pale wooden crates emblazoned with phrases and exotic alphabets. George Ferris's steel arrived on 5 trains of 30 cars each. From Baltimore came a long, dark train that chilled the hearts of the men and women who monitored its passage across the prairie, but delighted the innumerable small boys who raced open-jawed to the rail bed. The train carried weapons made by the Essen Works of Fritz Krupp, the German arms baron, including the largest artillery piece until then constructed, capable of firing a 1-ton shell with enough force to penetrate 3 feet of wrought iron plate. The barrel had to be carried on a specially made car, consisting of a steel cradle straddling 2 extra-long flat cars. The gun weighed 250,000 pounds. It quickly acquired the nickname Krupp's Pet Monster. A train with a more lighthearted cargo also headed for Chicago, this one leased by Buffalo Bill for his Wild West show. It carried a small army, 100 former U.S. cavalry soldiers, 97 Cheyenne, Kiowa, Pawnee, and Sioux Indians, another 50 Cossacks and Hussars, 180 horses, 18 buffalo, 10 elk, 10 mules, and a dozen other animals. It also carried Phoebe Ann Moses of Tiffin, Ohio, a young woman with a penchant for guns and an excellent sense of distance. Bill called her Annie. The press called her Miss Oakley. At night, the Indians and soldiers played cards. Ships began converging on U.S. ports from all over the world, bearing exposition cargoes of the most exotic kind. Sphinxes, mummies, coffee trees, and ostriches. By far the most exotic cargo, however, was human. Alleged cannibals from Dahomey, Lapps from Lapland, Syrian horsemen. On March 9th, a steamer named Guildhall set sail for New York from Alexandria, Egypt, carrying 175 bona fide residents of Cairo, recruited by an entrepreneur named George Pangalos to inhabit his street in Cairo in the Midway Plaisance. In the Guildhall's holds, he stashed 20 donkeys, 7 camels, and an assortment of monkeys and deadly snakes. His passenger list included one of Egypt's foremost practitioners of the danse du ventre, the young and lushly feminine Farida Mazar, destined to become a legend in America. Pangalos had secured choice ground at the middle of the Midway, adjacent to the Ferris wheel, in a Muslim diaspora that included a Persian concession, a Moorish palace, and Saul Bloom's Algerian village, where Bloom had converted the Algerians' premature arrival into a financial windfall. Bloom was able to open his village as early as August 1892, well before dedication day, and within a month had covered his costs and begun reaping a generous profit. The Algerian version of the danse du ventre had proven a particularly powerful draw once people realized the phrase meant belly dance. Rumors spread of half-clad women jiggling away, when in fact the dance was elegant, stylized, and rather chaste. The crowds poured in, Bloom said. I had a gold mine. Sad news arrived from Zanzibar. There would be no pygmies. Lieutenant Shufeld was dead, of unclear causes. After his failed run for the mayoral office of 1891, Carter Henry Harrison had acquired a newspaper, the Chicago Times, and settled into the job of editor. By the end of 1892, however, he had made it clear that he would love to be the fair mayor and lead the city through its most glorious time, but insisted that only a clear signal of popular demand could make him enter the campaign. He got it. Carter H. Harrison Associations sprang up all over town, and now, at the start of 1893, Carter was one of two candidates for the Democratic nomination, the other being Washington Hessing, editor of the powerful German daily Stadtzeitung. Every newspaper in the city other than his own Times opposed Harrison, as did Burnham and most of Chicago's leading citizens. To Burnham and the others, the new Chicago as symbolized by the white city rising in Jackson Park required new leadership, certainly not Harrison. The city's legion of working men disagreed. They always had counted Harrison as one of their own, R. Carter, even though he was a plantation-reared Kentucky man who had gone to Yale, spoke fluent French and German, and recited lengthy passages from Shakespeare. He had served four terms. That he should serve a fifth in the year of the fair seemed fitting, and a wave of nostalgia swept the city's wards. Even his opponents recognized that Harrison, despite his privileged roots, made an intensely appealing candidate for the city's lesser tier. Harrison was magnetic. Although he was 68, he still exuded strength and energy, and women generally agreed that he was more handsome now than he'd been in his 50s. Widowed twice, he was rumored to be involved with a much younger woman. He had deep blue eyes with large pupils and an unwrinkled face. He attributed his youthful aspect to a heavy dose of morning coffee. His quirks made him endearing. He loved watermelon. When it was in season, he ate it at all three meals. Almost everyone had seen him riding the streets on his white Kentucky mare, in his black slouch hat, trailing a plume of cigar smoke. To the astonishment of the city's ruling class, 78% of the 681 delegates to the Democratic Convention voted for Harrison on the first ballot. Patrick Prendergast, the young mad Irish immigrant, took pride in Harrison's renewed popularity and believed his own efforts at promoting the ex-mayor for re-election had a lot to do with the campaign's new momentum. An idea came to Prendergast. Just when it entered his brain, he could not say, but it was there and it gave him satisfaction. He had read extensively into law and politics and understood that political machines operated on a first principle of power. If you worked to advance the interests of the machine paid you back. Harrison was in his debt. Once elected, Prendergast believed, Harrison would offer him an appointment. He would have to. It was the law of the machine. As immutable as the forces that propelled the Chicago Limited across the prairie, Prendergast wanted to be corporation counsel, no more dealing with newsboys who did not know their place. When Harrison took office, salvation would come to Prendergast. The idea caused moments of exultation. Prendergast bought more postcards and sent exuberant notes to the men who soon would be his associates and clubmates, the judges, lawyers, and merchant princes of Chicago. In April 1893, the citizens of Chicago elected Carter Henry Harrison to his fifth term. In preparation for the fair, he ordered 200 barrels of whiskey to be used by his office in the entertainment of dignitaries. He gave no thought whatsoever to Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast, a mistake as it happens, and one of grave consequence for himself, the fair, and Burnham. For the moment, Holmes held off on doing anything more with Minnie's property. Minnie had told her sister Anna of the transfer of the Fort Worth land, and now Holmes sensed that Anna was becoming suspicious of his true intentions. This did not trouble him, however. The solution was really quite simple. One bright and fragrant spring day, as if on a wild equinoctial whim, Holmes suggested that Minnie invite her sister to Chicago to see the World's Fair, at his expense. Minnie was delighted and sent the good news to Anna, who immediately accepted. Holmes knew she would, for how could she have done otherwise? The chance to see Minnie was compelling in itself. Add Chicago and the great fair, and the combination became too alluring to turn down, no matter what Anna suspected about his and Minnie's relationship. Minnie could hardly wait for the end of the school year when her sister at last would be able to extricate herself from her duties at the Midlothian Academy. Minnie planned to show Anna all the wonders of Chicago, the skyscrapers, Marshall Field Store, the auditorium, and of course, the World's Fair. But above all, she looked forward to introducing Anna to her own personal wonder, Mr. Henry Gordon, her Harry. At last, Anna would see that she could put her suspicions to rest. In the first 2 weeks of April 1893, the weather was gorgeous, but other cruelties abounded. 4 exposition workers lost their lives, 2 from fractured skulls, 2 electrocuted. The deaths brought the year's total to 7. The exposition's union carpenters, aware of their great value in this final phase of construction, seized the moment and walked off the job, demanding a minimum union wage and other long-sought concessions. Only one of the 8 towers of the Ferris wheel was in place. Frank Millett's whitewash gang worked furiously to paint the buildings of the Court of Honor. The air of anxious effort that suffused the park reminded Candace Wheeler, the designer hired to decorate the woman's building, of an insufficiently equipped household preparing for visitors. Despite the carpenter's strike and all the work yet to be done, Burnham felt optimistic, his mood bolstered by the fine weather. The winter had been deep and long, but now the air was scented with first blossoms and thawed earth, and he felt loved. In late March, he had been feted at a grand banquet, arranged largely by Charles McKim and held in New York at Madison Square Garden. Without a doubt, huge progress had been made. The 6 grandest buildings of the exposition towered over the central basin with an effect more dramatic and imposing than even he had imagined. Daniel Chester French's Statue of the Republic, nicknamed Big Mary, stood in the basin complete and gleaming, its entire surface gilded. Including plinth, the Republic was 111 feet tall. Over 200 other buildings erected by states, corporations, and foreign governments stippled the surrounding acreage. Even the carpenter strike did not trouble Burnham. There seemed to be plenty of unemployed non-union carpenters willing to step in for the absent strikers. "I fear nothing at all from this source," he wrote on April 6th in a letter to Margaret. "The day was cold but clear, bright, and beautiful, a splendid day to live and work in. Workers were putting in the embellishments," he wrote. "A lot of ducks were put in the lagoons yesterday, and they are floating around contentedly and quite like life this morning." Over the next few days, his mood changed. There was talk that other unions might join the carpenter's strike and bring all work in Jackson Park to a halt. Suddenly, the exposition seemed dangerously far from ready. Construction of the sheds for the stock exhibits at the south end of the grounds had yet to begin. Everywhere Burnham looked, he saw rail tracks and temporary roads, empty boxcars and packing crates. Tumbleweeds of excelsior roved the grounds. There was disarray in the fairgrounds, but not next door on the 15 acres of ground leased by Buffalo Bill for his show, which now bore the official title Buffalo Bill's Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World. He was able to open his show on April 3rd and immediately filled his 18,000-seat arena. Visitors entered through a gate that featured Columbus on one side under the banner Pilot of the Ocean, the First Pioneer, and Buffalo Bill on the other, identified as Pilot of the Prairie, the Last Pioneer. His show and camp covered 15 acres. Its hundreds of Indians, soldiers, and workers slept in tents. Annie Oakley always made hers very homey, with a garden outside of primrose, geranium, and hollyhock. Inside she placed her couch, cougar skins, an Axminster carpet, rocking chairs, and assorted other artifacts of domestic life, and of course a diverse collection of guns. Buffalo Bill always began his show with his cowboy band playing the Star Spangled Banner. The climax of the show was the attack on a settler's cabin, during which Indians, who once had slaughtered soldiers and civilians alike, staged a mock attack on a cabin full of white settlers, only to be vanquished yet again by Buffalo Bill and a company of cowboys firing blanks. As the season advanced, Cody replaced the attack with the even more dramatic Battle of the Little Bighorn, showing with historical accuracy the scene of Custer's last charge. Fearful that a wider strike could hobble the fair, even destroy it, Burnham began negotiations with the carpenters and ironworkers, and agreed at last to establish a minimum wage and to pay time and a half for extra hours, double time for Sundays and key holidays, including, significantly, Labor Day. The union men in turn signed a contract to work until the end of the fair. Burnham claimed the agreement was a victory for the exposition, but in fact, the fair's concessions were a breakthrough for organized labor, and the resulting contracts became models for other unions to emulate. The fair's capitulation pumped steam into America's and Chicago's already boiling labor movement. Olmsted returned to Chicago, accompanied by his usual troika of affliction, and found the place galvanized, Burnham everywhere at once. On Thursday, April 13th, Olmsted wrote to his son John, "Everybody here in a keen rush, the greatest in imaginable outward confusion. Winds raced over the park's barren stretches and raised blizzards of dust. Train after train arrived, bearing exhibits that should have been installed long before. The delayed installations meant that temporary tracks and roads had to remain in place. Despite all this, when he looked past the immediate delay, he saw progress. The shore of the wooded island was just now beginning to burst forth in a dense profusion of new leaves and blossoms, and the Japanese temple, the Huden, crafted in Japan and assembled by Japanese artisans, detracted little from the sylvan effect. The electric boats had arrived and were lovely, exactly what Olmsted had hoped for, and the waterfowl on the lagoons provided enchanting sparks of energy in counterpoint to the static white immensity of the Court of Honor." Olmsted recognized that Burnham's forces could not possibly finish patching and painting by May 1st, and that his own work would be far from complete. But he saw a clear improvement. "A larger force is employed," he wrote, "and every day's work tells." Rain began to fall. At first, it did not trouble Burnham. It suppressed the dust that rose from the unplanted portions of the grounds, of which he was disappointed to see there were far too many, and by now all the roofs were finished. "It rains," Burnham wrote to Margaret on Tuesday, April 18th, "and for the first time I say let it. My roofs are in such good order at last. As to leaks, we care little." But the rain continued and grew heavier. At night, it fell past the electric lights in sheets so thick they were nearly opaque. It turned the dust to mud, which caused horses to stagger and wagons to stall, and it found leaks. On Wednesday night, a particularly heavy rain came pounding through Jackson Park, and soon a series of 200-foot cataracts began tumbling from the glass ceiling of the manufacturer's building onto the exhibits below. Burnham and an army of workers and guards converged on the building and together spent the night fighting the leaks.